This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, "My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing." And when she bore her, she said, "My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan." Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, "O Mary, from where does this come for you?" She said, "It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio, and I'm your host, Asma. I hope you have enjoyed our program up until now. Up next, we have news keeping you updated with the latest headlines. Then we have Radio Productions, delivering another wave of informative content curated just for you by our dedicated team. Next up, the Ocean of Da'a dives deep into spiritual supplications. In this program, we reflect on the rich spiritual heritage of Islamic supplications and ziyarat texts passed down from the Ahlul Bayt as beautifully preserved in Du'a collections like Mafatih al-Jinan. Each episode offers a brief yet meaningful commentary on selected du'as and ziyarat. Following that, another segment of Radio Productions, we've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Discover something new with us. Stay tuned for the news, please.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Death toll for Israel's genocide in Gaza is approaching 70,000 as the regime kills more Palestinians in blatant violation of a ceasefire. Thousands take to the streets of the U.S. Capitol to voice opposition to the administration's policies and call for the removal of President Donald Trump. And U.S. military is reportedly preparing to launch a new phase of operations targeting Venezuela as Washington intensifies efforts to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News. Our top story, the death toll from Israel's genocide in Gaza keeps rising despite a ceasefire deal as the regime continues truce violations across the war-torn territory. Israel's latest attacks claimed the lives of at least 24 Palestinian civilians in northern and central Gaza while leaving 87 others wounded. Strikes come after the regime falsely claimed an attack on its soldiers, which was categorically rejected by Hamas. Regime forces also conducted large-scale demolitions across Gaza City and deployed a heavy fire belt targeting southern cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah. According to the Gaza Government Media Office, since the truce started back on the 10th of October, Israel has committed nearly 500 violations, with 27 committed on Saturday alone. Regime violations have so far killed over 340 Palestinian civilians and left nearly 900 injured. And the overall death toll since October of 2023 due to the U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide has now exceeded 69,700 Palestinians, with over 171,000 injured. And for more on your Gaza update, we're earlier joined by our correspondent out of central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, Moti Abu Musabeh.
Gaza Strip are still witnessing more cruel attacks by the Israeli occupation forces. We are talking about chronic artillery strikes are still targeting the eastern side of Gaza City, particularly Al-Shija'iyah, in addition to Al-Tifah neighborhoods. In the meantime, the eastern side of Al-Burj refugee camp was hit a short while ago with more artillery strikes as well, coupled with the extensive and intense gunfire targeting the Palestinian people in those areas. Needless to mention that Khan Yunis City, or the eastern section of Khan Yunis City, is still one of the focal attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. So we are still witnessing this conspicuous surge of those Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement, and those violations are still underway brazenly before the eyes of the whole world, before the eyes of the mediators who are still shrugging off what's happening on the ground. They are still unable to oblige the Israeli regime to abide by the terms of the ceasefire agreement. So for the Palestinian people on the ground, they are still living the same sentiment that they used to live during the genocidal war, particularly for those who are still taking shelter near the so-called yellow line. Those attacks are still undertaken while the Palestinian people on the ground are still suffering severely from the ongoing and the persistent policy that the Israeli regime is still espousing regarding, as you know, hindering the humanitarian supplies allowed into Gaza Strip. They are still wickedly trying to stymie, as you know, the flow of those humanitarian supplies to the people here. The people are still suffering severely from the lack of the basic nutrients, the basic life-saving materials, including, as you know, the makeshift tents and the medical appliances, the medical aid and supplies.
The Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned Israel's frequent violations of the Gaza ceasefire under the pretext that attacks on its forces. Now, the movement says the regime is fabricating these pretexts to evade this agreement and restart its war of extermination. Hamas said it's called on mediators now to intervene immediately and force Israel to implement the agreed-upon ceasefire and stop evading its obligations. The movement's remarks come after Israel launched new deadly strikes across Gaza, killing over 24 Palestinians. The regime claims strikes are in response to an attack on its forces, accusing Hamas of violating the ceasefire. But Hamas has rejected the claim, saying it has demanded mediators pressure Israel to reveal the identity of the gunman the regime claims was sent by the movement. Hamas also rejected reports released by Israeli sources alleging the movement has informed U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff that the truce has ended. It also said Israel is the only party that continues to violate the agreement on a daily and systematic basis. And joining us earlier with his input out of Northern California was analyst and political commentator Paul Lurudi.
Israel has never, since its founding, abided by any international law. And the only way it survives is with the support of more powerful, let's say, patrons that also do not abide by international law and are happy to support Israel's destruction of populations and habitations that in order to establish the goals of the Zionist project. So the only road to success, which was articulated by several members of the resistance, including, of course, Hamas and notably Yahya Sinwar, the only role is to have an effective and growing resistance that makes occupation and genocide intolerable. Intolerable to the Zionist authority.
The international charity Doctors Without Borders has warned that humanitarian aid reaching Gaza remains far below what is needed despite the ceasefire. MSF said that there is no tangible improvement in aid delivery. People of Gaza will once again face very harsh winter. It added the ceasefire has not stopped Palestinian deaths due to Israel's frequent violations. MSF noted the Gaza ceasefire is very fragile, humanitarian aid is not reaching destinations, and suffering of civilians has yet to end. The group stressed that humanitarian aid is almost completely stopped since the ceasefire began on the 10th of last month, emphasizing not a single health facility in Gaza is fully operational. It called on the international community and all countries that can pressure Israel to force the regime to allow the entry of essential supplies. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says Israel has ignored every aspect of the ceasefire, adding the regime is pressing ahead with bombings and blocking aid, leaving Gaza starved amid medical crisis.
There is no ceasefire. The deal is a complete farce. Israel has not adhered to one aspect of it. It continues to bomb the Palestinians. It continues to withhold or to block the borders so that humanitarian aid cannot enter. Now, the entrance of humanitarian aid should never have been part of any ceasefire agreement. That should have been condemned and ended the first day that Israel announced it. The international community should have come together and forced Israel to leave the borders open. But the fact that they've been closed now for 7-8 months, people in Gaza are starving to death. They're dying from lack of medical attention. This is basic human rights. This is adherence to international law that people are not to be deprived of food and medical supplies. The Israeli regime continues to violate international law on every angle. There is no place that they're adhering to it. There is no way that they're adhering to the ceasefire. This entire situation, the starvation, the continued genocide, is all the responsibility of Israel and countries such as the United States, Canada, and others that continue to support Israel and that do not demand that the ceasefire terms be adhered to by both sides. So this is a criminal activity that much of the Western world is guilty of and complicit in.
And thousands of demonstrators have held another weekly protest in occupied territories to condemn Israeli Prime Minister's policy on Gaza. They're also demanding a committee be established to investigate regime security failures back in October of 2023. In Tel Aviv, protesters called for accountability from Benjamin Netanyahu over the captives' return. The demonstrators urge Israeli Premier to ensure all captive bodies are brought back while demanding a full probe into regime security failures related to Hamas Operation Al-Aqsa flood on October 7, 2023. Now, under the Gaza truce, Hamas released 20 living captives and agreed to return 28 bodies, two of which are still in Gaza. Hamas says Israel's continued breaches of the ceasefire making it extremely difficult to reach remaining bodies that are buried under tons of rubble left by regime's two-year campaign of destruction and genocide. Meanwhile, Israel presses ahead with land-grab policy across the occupied West Bank. In the latest development, regime has seized over 250 acres of Palestinian land in the northern Jordan Valley, claiming it will be used for military purposes. Now, according to the Wall and Settlement Resistance Authority, regime is planning to construct a new road extending from the village of Ein Shibli in the south to Al-Aqaba in the north, some 22 kilometers in length. It had seized plots of land have been chosen in a way to prevent local Palestinians from accessing grazing lands on the eastern plains, which amounts to thousands of acres. The authority noted, although regime claims it is building a so-called security road in the area, the project appears to be a strategic one, linking the northern Jordan Valley to the rest of occupied territories, and the project is apparently aimed at strengthening Israel's control over Palestinian agricultural lands, undermining geographical continuity of Palestinian communities. And joining us earlier with more of the stories from Ramallah correspondent Naka Ahmed.
In the Northern Valley is extreme, and the Palestinians over there are losing land, and it's inimaginable the situation over there, as the Israeli regime and the Israeli settlers are combining their forces to expel the Palestinians out of this very strategic area and very important area. Most of the Palestinian agriculture is in that area. In addition to that, most of the Palestinian water lies in that area. So we are now looking at a multidimensional problem for the Palestinians. In the village of Jabbat to the north of occupied Al-Quds, the Israeli settlers have attacked the Palestinians over there. And in addition to all of this, the targeting of the Palestinian workers, the news that you were talking about, Mehdi, which is the shooting of one Palestinian man, he is a worker trying to go through Aram village to the north of occupied Al-Quds, trying to cross over the separation wall to go to his work place into the occupied territories. But this is a strategy that we have been documenting more and more, the targeting, the deliberate targeting of the Palestinian workers. Now we are looking at almost 52 Palestinians have been killed in such attacks, not to mention tens that have been injured or disabled by the Israeli forces.
Thousands in the U.S. have gathered in Capitol, Washington, D.C. to call for the impeachment, conviction, and removal, that is, of President Donald Trump.
This is our watch. We cannot wait until some other time, hoping that things will get better in the meantime. No, things are not getting better. Things are getting worse. We must convict. We must impeach. We must have him removed.
Now, rally billed as Remove the Regime and organized by a grassroots group known as Removal Coalition has drawn a number of current and former officials. Protesters say the Trump administration has ignored the majority of Americans, fueling widespread public frustration. The demonstration comes during a record-setting year for nationwide protests amid growing discontent with the administration. Last month, more than 7 million people joined the No Kings protests, which unfolded during what later became a record-breaking government shutdown. The U.S. is reportedly preparing to launch a new phase of operations targeting Venezuela as the Trump administration intensifies pressure on President Nicolas Maduro. The two U.S. officials say options under review include attempting to overthrow Maduro, a step Caracas has long warned U.S. is seeking. Timing and scope of the planned operations remain unclear, but U.S. military forces have been building up in the Caribbean for months. This as Washington has already authorized covert CIA activities inside Venezuela. At least six international airlines have canceled flights departing from the country after U.S. Federal Aviation Administration warned of a potentially hazardous situation over Venezuelan airspace. Since September, U.S. has launched at least 21 strikes on fishing boats in the Pacific and Caribbean under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. Human rights groups called attacks illegal extrajudicial killings and warned of potential violations of international law. A coordinated wave of protests taking place across the UK just ahead of a landmark court hearing on whether the government's proscription of the direct action group Palestine Action was lawful. From London to Edinburgh and Cardiff, protesters are challenging the ban at a risk of arrest and imprisonment, as Saeed Puriza reports.
Next to the conscientious objector's commemorative stone, a demonstration rooted in conscience. Demonstrators, some from other parts of Europe, defying the elements and threats of arrest, holding placards that have become symbols of nonviolent action. Before long come the arrests. Since these protests first began in the summer, British police have arrested more than 2,000, charging hundreds under terror laws in a move the demonstrators say is to stifle dissent against the UK's complicity in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Palestine Action was proscribed by former Home Secretary Yvette Cooper in June this year. Membership of or support for the group is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. In an unprecedented move in British history, Palestine Action is challenging its prescription in this court starting November 25th in the form of a judicial review. If the High Court votes in favor of Palestine Action, the thousands of arrests and the hundreds of charges that were brought against demonstrators like these under the Terrorism Act of 2000 will also be quashed. A victory for Palestine Action would also have repercussions for its jailed members, six of whom are now on an open-ended hunger strike in prisons across Britain. Cyprus is up London.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Silence a man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence a man was burning. Keeping the light alive. To tell his secrets to our and bury his pains in the desert. A man who knew the ways in the heavens better than the ways on earth. Thank you.
the fall of Bashar al-Assad, a fleeting wave of hope swept across Syria. For a brief moment, many believed a better future was within reach. But those dreams quickly dissolved. The new dawn proved a mirage. Instead of renewal, Syria plunged deeper into crisis. I'm Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this is In a Nutshell. Power fractured, Israel seized the moment. Exploiting the chaos, it launched hundreds of strikes across Syrian territory and quietly expanded its footprints in the south. In the 2 days following Assad's overthrow, Israel carried out more than 500 airstrikes, targeting both military and civilian infrastructure. Since then, it has been occupying swaths of Quneitra and Dar'a under the banner of preventing extremist threats. Since Assad's fall, Israel's military presence has evolved from opportunistic incursions into a strategic project, one aimed at reshaping southern Syria to fit its security and economic map. From Quneitra to Jabal al-Sheikh, also known as Mount Hermon, Israeli forces have entrenched themselves along key highlands, water basins, and energy corridors. The new balance of power in the Levant increasingly revolves around two words, water and gas. Jabal al-Sheikh, the highest peak in the region, stands as the crown jewel of this expansion. At 2,814 meters, it offers an unrivaled surveillance hub, giving Israel a panoramic view from Damascus to the Mediterranean and deep into Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. To the southwest, Israeli forces have fortified Quneitra, extending their reach to within 20 kilometers of central Damascus. New positions in Rahla, opposite Lebanon's Baqa Valley, now oversee three key routes linking Damascus to Beirut and Baalbek, effectively giving Israel a hand on Syria's western gateways. In Soweida province, Israeli influence is spreading under the guise of supporting the Druze. Following the July 2024 formation of the so-called National Guard, a 3,000-strong Druze force reportedly funded by Israel, Tel Aviv's reach deepened. Netanyahu's public pledges to protect the Druze community signaled more than goodwill. They marked the birth of a semi-autonomous security zone loosely tied to Damascus. Beneath the rhetoric of security, however, lies a contest for control over energy routes and water reserves, the true currency of power in today's Levant. The revival of the long-stalled Qatar-Turkey gas pipeline has only sharpened these rivalries. Once blocked by Assad to protect Russian interests, the project roared back into life after its fall. In December 2024, Turkey's energy minister announced its potential restart once Syria stabilizes. For Israel, that's a red flag. A functioning Qatar-Turkey-Europe pipeline would undercut Israel's own East Med pipeline ambitions, a direct challenge to its vision of becoming Europe's next gas supplier. Analysts at the Begin Sadat Center warn that this gas race pits two visions against each other. Ankara's dream of an Islamic energy corridor versus Tel Aviv's push for a Mediterranean one. Both see Syria as the crucial crossroads. But Israel's ambitions go beyond gas. Control of water, the lifeblood of the region, has become another front. Through its hold over the Yarmouk River basin and the Al-Wehda Dam on the Syrian-Jordanian border, Israel now wields a strategic lever over both Syria and Jordan. The Golan Basin alone provides nearly a third of Israel's agricultural water needs, and every step deeper into southern Syria secures that lifeline. From Jabal al-Sheikh to Dar'a, Israel's control of springs, rivers, and dams, including Banyas, Raqqad, and Al-Manitra, has turned southern Syria into a meticulously managed zone of influence. In this reshaped landscape, fertile lands once tilled by Syrian farmers are being eyed for Israeli agricultural expansion, their crops destined for regional markets. These same corridors, rich in water and soil, double as potential land routes for future pipelines stretching from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean or Turkey.
The fall of Assad was supposed to bring about a bright season for Syria. Instead, it opened a new chapter of domination, one where Syria, fragmented and exhausted, has become a playground for power politics and expansionist ambitions. Israel's quiet conquest of the south is not just about borders, it's about resources, leverage, and rewriting the strategic map of the Levant.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمنه.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him. So we, the servants, must always try to acquire the merit to talk to our master, that absolute cause, that all-knowing, that all-seeing, that all-hearing. We should know that to privately talk to the worshipped being is more valuable than anything else. That you can talk to your ma'bud, that your master will listen to you. In one of his litanies, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam said, "Namatil uyun wa 'alatin nujum wa antal malikul hayyul qayyum." Eyes asleep and stars fall, yet you are the ever-living and self-existing king. "Ghallaqatil muluku abwabuha." وَأَقَامَتْ عَلَيْهَا حُرَّاسُهَا وَبَابُكَ مَفْتُوحٌ لِلسَّائِلِينَ Kings keep their castles' gates closed and assign guards on them. Yet your door is open to all those who knock. I come to you that you may look at me with your mercy, O most merciful of the merciful. In some supplications we read, O Lord, now is the time when every lover is alone with his partner, and they are talking intimately, and those who are not lovers as well as the animals are sleeping. All doors are closed, yet the doors of your forgiveness and your munificence are wide open. There are no guards to hinder anyone from entering your court of bounty. Whoever wants to call is free to call you, and you answer him. Moreover, you yourself call your servants, and your invitation is always open. You have said in the Holy Quran, is there anyone who regrets committing wicked acts and intends to return to me so that I may admit him? What mercy and compassion this is towards sinners who pay no attention to you and commit evil acts with impunity. Instead of the servant entreatingly and earnestly asking for your acceptance, it is you who invite your servant. Come, come that I may accept you. Uduni astajib lakum. So we must see who our master is. We must know him. We must acquire that knowledge about him. We must acquire more knowledge about him. Because he is the one that admits everybody without any discrimination. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has said, La yashghaluhu sha'nun an sha'n. No action hinders him from engaging in another. You know what that means, dear listeners? It means that if you suppose that the prophets, those nearest angels, and those awliya, those divine people are busy supplicating him, he is not negligent of us. He's not negligent of the others. If a common person in a certain part of the world calls him, he will definitely answer him.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Can you find any master who remembers his servants even after months or years of no contact? I mean, we have all experienced or we have all seen these cases, those people who have forgotten about God. They live in, continue their lives without even remembering, without even trying to remind themselves that there is a God up above there. But after something dreadful happens to them, they start to remember, there has been a God and I was neglectful of him. Let me ask you, is it then proper to pay attention to everything except him at the time of prayer and supplication? Well, if this is the case, if he is our God, I assume this is impolite to worship him sluggishly and heedlessly. Or even some of us think that he is indebted to us because of our worship. And I don't know what happens to some of us when we try to supplicate to God despondently. I mean, how is that possible if we believe that he is the absolute cause, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-hearing? He's able to do whatever he wants. How did we try to talk to him despondently? And we should believe that those doors of God's mercy are ever open. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery to face dreadful events. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Every day I witness calamity. Every day I witness your tragedy. When my Lord gave me my eyes, he drew on them your figure. So wherever I would see the son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? But then my eyes would see the son of Ali alone, no family crying, who will help me? And I watch as by walls you are circled, and I watch as my beloved is killed. Every day it's with me a memory. Every day I witness your tragedy. Within the realm of your love I awoke and I wondered, whenever I called your name, it was Zainab that answered. You call for my brother, expecting an answer. I ran between fire and he would not answer. You call for my brother, expecting an answer. I ran between fire and he would not answer. I cried out, running after his children. I cried out, wanting him to assist them. Every day I ask him to come to me. Every day I witness your tragedy. I was thirsty for your love. Your name on my heart was drawn. I asked you to quench this thirst and was met by two hands tall.
remember him every day. Hussein's banner I carry every day. I witness your tragedy. Just like a moth to a flame, I was drawn to your beauty. You became my every thought. Loving you was a duty. But when I'd remember you, I would see shimmer. I'd see a head severed, raised high upon a spear, and I weep whenever I recall you, and I weep whenever I think of you every day, Hussein, daily and nightly, every day I witness your tragedy.
There are scholars who delve into the complexities of geopolitics and international relations, examining the forces that shape global dynamics. Their work often bridges theoretical frameworks and practical implications, bringing insights into the interplay of security, economics, and diplomacy. Among them are those who focus on Eurasian integration and the evolving role of conservatism in global politics. My guest today exemplifies this dedication, contributing to academic discourse and shaping perspectives on international affairs. I am Bahman Nouray, your host. Welcome to SOAP. Glenn Deason is a Norwegian political scientist and author born in 1979. He specializes in international relations, geopolitics, geoeconomics, and Russian foreign policy. His academic work often explores the interplay between security institutions, conservatism, and Eurasian integration. Deason has also contributed to journals like Russia in Global Affairs and authored several books on geopolitics and international relations. Mr. Glenn Deason, it's a pleasure to have you here on SOAP.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. I want to start with what in your childhood or maybe your teen years inspired you to get interested and go after geopolitics and international relations?
Well, I always had a bit of an interest, at least after the Cold War in the 90s. I was quite optimistic about the possibility for Europe to unify, a bit like what I've done with France and Germany, but then, we're bringing in Russia, so having a unified common Europe. When I was in the army in 1998-99, it was a bit of a disappointment to see that we were instead bombing Yugoslavia and creating a Europe without the Russians by expanding NATO. Initially I did a business degree, I had a master of business. I actually moved to Russia almost 20 years ago to explore commerce, common business interest, and I was swept away by their politics. So that's went back to uni and got re-educated.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I wanted to talk to you about, because you pursued degrees in commerce, business, international relations across multiple universities. That's what I wanted to ask, what took you in that path? And tell me, and of course you speak Russian as well. Tell us about your experience in Russia. What did you find which was maybe different from the mainstream narrative of Russia?
Well, I moved there in 2006 because I wanted to look at some of the common economic interests, because both Norway and Russia, we have, you know, fisheries, natural resources. And so I studied there, yeah, Russian language and history. And what really took my interest, though, was outside of this, which was the narratives we told, because, you know, the stories we tell, what happened after the Cold War, what happened in the 90s, early 2000s, you hear the stories that the Russians say and what's coming out of the West. And we're talking about the same thing, but there's nothing in common. It's completely two different narratives. And often your first instinct is, oh, well, I guess it's, you know, Russians have propaganda. But then, you know, you look into it and you find out that actually their narratives have often more evidence to it. And instead, you find a lot of holes in your own narratives. And you realize that, you don't understand your opponents anymore. And when you don't understand your opponents, you tend to pursue very foolish policies. And so I was immediately, took a great interest, not just in Russian history, but its politics as well.
You know, as a specialist in international relations, of course, why do you think that historically Europe has never been close enough with Russia rather than getting close with America?
Yeah, well, that is the absurd situation we have today, which is also a key flaw in the European security architecture. That is, the main European actor today is the United States, which is a non-European country. Meanwhile, the largest country in Europe in terms of population, territory, economy, military, so across the board, which is Russia. And they're the only country who's now demoted to not even being a European country. So one has to ask oneself, do we really think this is going to lead to stability? That, you know, at the moment, the foreign policy chief of the European Union, for example, is from Estonia, a country with, I think, about 1.3 million. Meanwhile, they have a seat at the table. Meanwhile, Russia, with 145 million, they do not have a seat. And then that begs the question, how do we recognize their security concerns? How do we accommodate this? And we don't. We don't even discuss Russian security concerns. It is quite remarkable. So one shouldn't be surprised that we end up in conflicts with the Russians if they're not represented, and we don't even talk about their security concerns.
And even now, when you think of it, the situation today, the United States is kind of going around Europe and talking to Russia. So it's kind of, Europe is out of the loop a little bit. Why do you think this has come to it?
Well, I think in this peace negotiations, I think the Europeans are seen as being unrealistic and unreliable by both Washington as well as Moscow. Now, this isn't even, it's worth noting that after the Russian invasion in 2022, you had President Macron of France. He actually tried to have some conversations with Putin, and the rest of the Europeans, they pulled him back, arguing, no, we don't do diplomacy with Russia. We're going to isolate them internationally. And he warned, actually, that, you know, if we don't talk to the Russians, then peace in Europe will be negotiated by a non-European power, which is now the United States. So the Europeans, they kind of handed this over, and no one's preventing them from picking up the phone and calling Moscow. But for 3 years now, they boycotted diplomacy while all these hundreds of thousands of young men died on the front lines, and they still don't want to pick up the phone and call Russia and try to get in and start some diplomacy. Instead, the key impulse now seems to be to try to undermine what Trump was, not a perfect peace, obviously, but what he was pursuing.
Right, and at the same time, I think there is some sort of, you know, disheveled look within the European Union regarding the issue of Ukraine. What policy are they exactly following right now?
I don't know, and I think this is a part of the problem. There's no strategic clarity. That is, it's not clear what they want to achieve. Some are saying that we can't negotiate, we have to win, but if we recognize that this is an issue, this is considered to be an existential threat to Russia, that means they will fight till the end. And Russia just happens to be the world's largest nuclear power. How exactly do we define victory? There is no victory. And indeed, What's been revealed is the Americans, they never really wanted to send so much weapon that they could destroy or defeat Russia, because that would be nuclear war. They realized this. They just sent enough weapons to bleed the Russians, that is to send the Ukrainians to die and hope to kill some Russians and weaken a strategic adversary. But the idea that you can defeat Russia is foolish. So if you can't defeat the Russians, what is the goal? Are you going to negotiate with them? No, they don't want to do this either. You had the foreign policy chief talking about breaking Russia into pieces. You know, they don't talk to, they don't want to talk to Putin because they say he's a war criminal. So we don't do with diplomacy. We want to take on the world's largest nuclear power. There's a lack of strategic thinking here, and I think this is really undermining our security in Europe.
And where do you think this is going now? How do you think this conflict is going to end?
Well, we're losing it.
What would you bet on?
Well, NATO is losing the war. We're running out of weapons and we're running out of Ukrainians. So it's just going to get worse every day we wait. So every day we wait, Ukrainians lose more men. We have even less weaponry. And the Ukrainians lose more infrastructure, more territory. So it's... the former advisor of Zelensky, Arestovich, he was saying we should take this deal by the Russians, that is neutrality and territorial concessions. And he recognized that if we don't give away four territories, we're going to lose eight. So I think in Europe, a key problem is there's wishful thinking. It's that we can't accept that Russia determines if Ukraine should be a part of NATO. So we're not going to let them have a voice. But if you don't let Russia have a voice, they will have to use military force, which is what they've done. If you don't accept a territorial concession, the alternative isn't to get all the territory back, it's to lose twice as much. And I think this is the problem. So people, they become very moralistic and they take a very maximalistic position and they think that this is somehow expresses their moral, because no, we will not accept one inch of Ukrainian territory lost. But if the alternative is hundreds of thousands of more Ukrainians dead, a nation destroyed, and even more territory lost, why is this moral? And no one seems to answer this.
Right. But do you think that if like wearing the shoes of Mr. Zelensky, for example, here, do you think that if this becomes sort of a pattern, if he agrees to this, anywhere else in the world there might be a conflict and then easily say, okay, you want to settle down? Okay, this part of your country now belongs to the other country, to your neighbor. It's fine. People are not going to get killed. Don't you think that this is going to like change the whole shape, geopolitical shape of the entire world?
Well, that's the premise in which we see now many Western countries do not want to give any concessions to Russia, because the narrative is, this was an unprovoked invasion. The Russians invaded because they wanted territory. If we give them the territory, we right. reward them. So now we're sending a signal to the rest of the world, anyone can go and take territory. Yeah. So if you accept the premise, then it makes sense. My point is, I don't buy into the premise. Russia never invaded because it wanted territory.
Right.
They've been saying since the 90s, we need a proper inclusive European security architecture. Yeah. Because when you expand NATO closer and closer to the Russian borders, exactly. it's considered yes. a threat. And it shouldn't be controversial. A lot of Western leaders, politicians, military leaders, intelligence officials, ambassadors, they all recognize throughout the years that this was an existential threat to the Russians. Even Angela Merkel once said that taking Ukraine into NATO would be considered a declaration of war against Russia. So we know that this wasn't about territory. The loss of territory is the symptom or the consequence of it. So I think if we recognize that the war started because Russia sees NATO expansion as an existential threat,
right.
then suddenly the lesson is very different. If we don't make any compromise now, it can only escalate, because there's no way Russia would ever accept NATO in Ukraine, or that Donbas should again fall into Ukrainian control. So one doesn't have to think this is just or good, but I think it's very dangerous, this premise we keep pushing, that right. this was unprovoked and that they just wanted territory.
Yeah.
It's again, it feels very moral. Something we say, so we'll be the good guy, but it prevents yes. peace, because there's no solution to right. this conflict if we just say this is just the Russian imperialism.
Of course, Glenn, that the Ukraine conflict is not the only one currently in the world. We have the situation in the Middle East, in Gaza and Palestine, to be exact. You know, always the narrative, the mainstream narrative is always that the collective West cares so much about issues like human rights issues, women and children issues, and that sort of stuff. But when it comes to the women and children in Gaza today, they seem to be, at the very best, indifferent. Why do you think this has become like this?
Well, as you said, I think the narratives become overwhelming. They're so dominant that facts have less to say. So, again, all narratives and all conflicts around the world have to be framed somehow as a struggle between good and evil. So, with the Russians we have one, but in the Middle East it's the same. If you have, for example, these tensions between Israel and Iran, then well, Israel is the liberal democracy, freedom, human rights. Iran is like a terrorist state. It's a big Taliban camp, essentially. This is how Iran is portrayed. Yeah. And once something is the good versus evil, then people are often convinced that, you know, you can look away from some of this collateral damage because it's for a good cause. Often this would be the mindset. Now, I think, as you say, I think it's taking a... I think what's happened in Gaza has ruined a lot of... well, punched a hole in these narratives because it's very hard to explain how... our foreign policies are organized around human rights when one is assisting, not just looking the other way, but actually assisting a genocide. So watching all these thousands of children being murdered and still not mustering up the courage to criticize or call on restraint, but instead sending more weapons, I think this is, it's a immensely problematic. I think a lot of people are waking up and figuring out something's not really right with this narrative. And that's just Gaza. You can look at Syria. The Americans had a bounty on the head of Jolani, and suddenly the next day he's our new friend and ally.
How quickly things change!
Very quickly. They didn't have time to remove the bounty on his head before he was renovated.
Recognizing him.
Yeah. So no longer was he Al Qaeda. He's now he's now a reformist. You know, and he puts on a new coat, a jacket, and. And suddenly, oh, look, he's reformed. And all the newspapers push these ridiculous headlines. And I think many people were also appalled by what the EU did. That is, when the new authorities in Syria was massacring the Alawites, the EU actually went out with a tweet blaming the Alawites for provoking it. It's quite remarkable and it's so damaging for us as well, for the Europeans, because we were told that these values were central. It's what will bind all the Europeans together. It's what will define us. And then they show how little it's worth, that it can just be, you know, thrown away and dismissed in such a crude manner. So I think, again, it's horrible here for the region, of course, but it's also a lot of self-harm for the Europeans because we're destroying who we were supposed to be.
Of course. And we mentioned Syria, of course. What do you think the situation in that country is going to end up like? Do you think it's going to be like what we witnessed in a certain period in Afghanistan?
I think it's going to be chaos. I think a lot of the partnerships you need saw, they were only premised on being anti-Assad. There was a coalition of different countries and groups who wanted to have regime change, to topple him. So you have the United States, you have... many of the Europeans, you have the Saudis, UAE, you have Turkey, you have Israel, all of them kind of playing a role. But once Assad is gone, the anti-Assad coalition is over. Now, what is the new Syria going to look like? And I think it's much more likely now that you're going to see a clash between the different actors. And you indeed, I think at the forefront of this, Israel and Turkey is definitely, Turkey would like to see Syria more or less a protectorate of Turkey. Israel, I think they want to carve it up into smaller pieces.
And in the beginning, they looked like they were like allies in this. But now, day by day, they're like kind of facing up to one another. And I think it's another case of just trying to destroy a country in order to gain control, but for control to actually go out of your hands.
Oh, well, this is... I don't think they planned, they had a, well, not an exit strategy, but I don't think they planned for the day after. Once the regime change is over, what now? And I think this exposes how little they have in common. I mean, the idea that Israel and Turkey would have a common future, a vision for what Syria should look like, it was always foolish. I remember I wrote an article right after Assad was toppled and pointed out this is, you know, the anti-Assad alliance is over. This is, they're going to start to have more tensions. And what about the Americans? How will they, you know, they will probably want to lean more in towards the supporting the Kurds that will also go against the government there. So, no, it's,